the quickest way to get out of a problem is to stop digging the hole deeper. And we took a look at sources of PAHs and found that one significant source, and I want to make sure that we're understood that we're not claiming that this is the sole source, the only source, or that there aren't other major contributing sources of PAHs into these ponds. But we know that the driveway sealants that have a coal tar base to them is a significant source. This is based on research that we received through the state of Minnesota, through the Pollution Control Agency, as well as the U.S. Geological Survey that conducted specific tests in that area. Our city council recently adopted an ordinance which prohibits the sale and or application of those materials in our city. And this was after a lot of consideration. We wanted to make sure that that decision was based on fair science, as well as that there was not an unreasonable economic impact. We checked with local vendors, retail sales of that material, and found that the alternative, which is an asphalt emulsion-based sealant, is available and in many cases is preferred. The reports and studies on this will show side-by-side comparisons of advantages and disadvantages of both products. But our local retailers actually supported the direction in which the city was going. They felt that from an environmental standpoint, it was the practical thing to do. And as Representative Scalzi explained, we contacted some of the large home improvement centers, which is the typical source for people doing it themselves. And we found that the coal tar-based products have been taken off their shelf. We also talked to some of the large manufacturers of the driveway sealants, and many, if not all of them, make both of the materials. And so they provide both as an alternative to their customers, and we felt that it was reasonable. So the city just recently, as I mentioned, the city council adopted that ordinance in part because we felt that something had to be done, and decided to proceed. So we will now be continuing to work with the state in hopes of finding other methods of treating the sediment. But in the meantime, as I said, felt that the quickest way out of a hole is to first stop digging. And then finally, as I said before too, we saw that this was a source that was identifiable and quantifiable, and for which there was an alternative. We're not telling people they shouldn't seal their pavements, but we think that there is a comparable alternative for them. Okay. My remarks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sather. And you said it's quantifiable as far as the amount of contamination coming from the coal tar or sealant. Do you know what percent of the contamination is caused by that? I know you're saying there's some others, you know, sources as well. But is this more than half of the problem, or do you have a figure?
Mr. Chair, that actually goes beyond my skill level in terms of science, but the research that we saw, both from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as well as its citing of federal studies, indicated that there was a range of sources, and it depended upon even the location in the country where it was, different freeze-thaw cycles, different climatic conditions, and so forth. But we would not say that it was more than half. But it was, as I say, you know, anything that has a petroleum base to it. So other sources would be things like automotive engines dripping oil or dripping fuel in a parking lot and then having rainwater coming off of that. So those are other sources. But more difficult for us to find an alternative or a corrective action to reduce that.
Thank you. And Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, next we have Paul Bolstead, who is a resident of White Bear Lake, who would like to give some added remarks.
Welcome, Mr. Bolstead. If you could state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Paul Bolstead. I'm a resident of White Bear Lake, and I'm a professor in the Department of Forest Resources and Geography and in the Water Resources Center here at the University of Minnesota. I've worked in various areas of water quality and quantity and development for the last 25 years here in Wisconsin and in the Southern Appalachians, in the outskirts of Atlanta. I can go a bit towards answering your last question about source, and it's uncertain in any one place where you haven't done a careful mass balance study, and a careful mass balance study is quite expensive. You're talking probably 3 years, 4 years of data collection, a lot of analysis. I mean, in round numbers, $250,000 to $750,000 to really nail down what the sources are. We haven't done one, I don't think, in Minnesota anywhere. There have been enough done around the country to identify rough numbers. And I would guess it's anywhere from a third to a half comes from surface flows from things like sealants. It's really a matter of concentration. In this room, the carbon dioxide concentration is certainly less than a tenth of a percent. If it gets to 1%, we all get sleepy. At 3%, we get dizzy. At 8%, we die. And the sealants have a high concentrations of PAHs. Now, there's no question to the science that PAHs are powerful carcinogens. It's one of the top 18 chemicals to watch that the EPA is interested in. There isn't a vertebrate that hasn't been tested that hasn't developed cancerous tumors. So fish, rats, mice, anything that you do the tests to, it's a carcinogen. Its primary problem is as a carcinogen that causes lung cancers, but it also causes a whole range of other kinds of cancers for this complex of PAHs. So there's no question that a main source, a major source, are sealants, and that it's a carcinogen. Now, the problem with these PAHs is that when they get in an aquatic environment, they're pretty much inert to biological decomposition. We're bathed in PAHs every day, but again, at low concentrations, and on the surface, they undergo microbial decomposition and transformations at slow rates. You get them in the stormwater ponds or in the lakes. There's a lot of direct injection of storm sewers into Lake Minnetonka, Lake Calhoun, White Bear Lake. These sediments then hold these noxious chemicals basically forever. If you do a vertical sample, you can look at the increase in concentration starting in the early 1900s, but really about 1940, 1950, almost any place they've sampled, you get increases in concentrations. And we're adding to the problem now. Now, it's clear that atmospheric deposition is a source. So when we burn fossil fuels, when we drive down the road, we're emitting PAHs from our tailpipe. But the rates of deposition are relatively low. It's dry deposition and wet deposition on the surface. The problem with the coal tar coming off of the PAHs off the roads is that it's at a higher concentration. For example, if you just take a 5-gallon bucket of the coal tar and spread it over an area equivalent to what you get to atmospheric deposition, that 5-gallon bucket to get the same amount of PAHs, you'd have to spread over something like 2,500 football fields. So you'd have to spread it at a very thin rate, and they're certainly spreading it, that 5 gallons, over a much smaller area when they apply it on a road or a parking lot. It's the concentration that's the problem, and it can undergo biological transformation once it's transported or entrained in the water and then dumped into the pond. So we're basically accumulating this in the bottom of areas where it can then bioaccumulate. And so it'll affect any use of that water. It's like mercury deposition in that the real risk is to kids and to women of childbearing age. A person applying it, someone like me, I'm unlikely to develop cancer. I have a much lower rate because I basically have much less of my life left than a child. But you're basically looking at, with kids' exposures to PAHs, increasing the cancer rate. So it really doesn't make sense to apply these when they're probably not the majority, but certainly an easily replaceable source of a common carcinogen. One more thing is that in reading the proposed legislation, or the proposed bill, it seems it says undiluted, and I don't know what's to keep these folks or people from coming up with formulations where they dilute it by 5% and leave 95% the original coal tar. So it seems to me you really should look at either levels of dilution or some more stringent standard, because if it's 30% PAHs and you stick in 5% of something else, well, now it's 29% and or 27, and you're still left with the problem. And sooner or later, you're going to have to clean it up, and sooner or later, it's going to be expensive. You have to pull it out of the ponds because it's toxic sediment and it's a hazardous waste that somebody has to handle. So even if you discount the costs of the health risks, you still have the costs of the disposal, and those aren't going away.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ballstead. And Mr. Johnson next. So welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I will keep my comments very brief so you can get to your other issues this morning as well. Just to point out that the example you just heard from White Bear Lake, which is very real and very expensive, is being replicated other places very quickly as cities start to have to check the sediment in their stormwater ponds. And while it's true that there are a number of sources of PAHs, these are ponds we are finding contaminated that are in entirely residential developments. They do not have freeways draining into them. They do not have major transportation corridors draining into them. The bulk of the things coming from this is running off from the streets and the driveways in residential subdivisions. And this is something that is not an affordable cost. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars to take the sludge out of a stormwater pond that previously used to be able to be spread as a fill and treat it as a hazardous material and take that tremendous amount of space out of the landfills we have access to in this state, having to put them into a lined landfill. We really don't need to be doing this. There are safe alternatives. We have asphalt sealants with a tiny fraction the amount of this contaminant in them, and switching to requiring that to be the sealant of use would simply make the concentration drop to a level where we don't have the toxicity in the sludge. That's all we're really looking at in this legislation. Is not to try and do anything other than recognize that there is a product that is currently used that local government is having to pay the cost of cleaning up. And it really is not an affordable cost, and there is a safe alternative for it that both the people in the business could switch to using and people on their private property could switch to using. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us time to raise these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for our testifiers? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you mentioned this earlier, perhaps I missed it, but was there any discussion of price difference in these 5-gallon buckets of one sealant versus another? Are they roughly comparable in cost to the consumer, or is there a big difference?
Mr. Sather.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as we understand and in checking with local vendors in the White Bear Lake area, they're comparable in price. There is, it's a little bit, as we said, it's a little bit like a Chevrolet or Ford comparison in terms, some people prefer one over the other, but we've had both end users as well as commercial applicators say that they are preferring the asphalt-based emulsion because of a variety of reasons, and that's in some of the literature that we've published.
Thanks. And Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I would just add that in checking with our city officials, we have very few that have used coal tar sealants for a very long time because they flake off so much more quickly than the asphalt sealants break down.
It's my understanding,
Mr. Ballstead,
that the coal tar-based sealant prices now are comparable to asphalt-based sealants, but asphalt-based sealants for a petroleum product, and they may well go up in price as the price of petroleum goes up. Now, folks will say that the coal tar-based sealants last longer. They do have less frequent reapplication rates because they look nicer longer. But I actually talked to a transportation engineer who does studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and if you apply at the same frequency every 3 years or every 5 years, you get the same lifetime wear on a road. So functionally, if you apply them at the same rates. Now, you might say consumers like the nice dark look that coal tar gives you longer, or there are certain instances where susceptibility to certain chemical spills, you need to use one versus another, but by and large, most folks applying them on their driveways, that doesn't apply. The real problem with coal tar with frequent applications on the driveways is that, as noted, the dusts that accrue from them, that flake off from them, are hazardous in and of themselves. For example, in a study in Texas, the levels were 500 times higher in dust in homes or apartment buildings next to parking lots that had coal tar-based sealants versus other surfaces for their parking lots. And they'll quibble with how the sampling was taken, but it was basically a double-blind study, a paired comparison for the strongest sort of analysis that you can have that really identifies the source of a particular event. So besides getting in the water, there's the coal tar dust. The rates of PAHs in the cities here in the air are about 10 times what they are if we drive outside the urban fringe, and that's because of this dust and flaking of not only driveway sealants, also roof sealants and other sealants.
Representative Scalzi.
And Mr. Chair, and members, in your packets, you have a handout that was produced by the Pollution Control Agency as a part of this bill that we had last year to prevent the state from using it. And this is the white paper that the Pollution Control Agency has put together that identifies the study, and also the study is noted on this handout that you have. Pollution Control Agency, I believe there's someone in the audience here. If there's questions, I'm not sure. I don't see anyone waving. There he is there. If you have questions, he would be willing to answer those.
Okay, thank you. One question I have, as far as the asphalt sealant, is there a significant shift to the use of that now? I was wondering if that's already in play to a large degree, or if I don't know, because of tradition, people are still using a lot of the coal tar sealant.
The West Coast, by and large, have used asphalt sealants forever. I think it's transportation. I'm not really sure why that is, my colleague at UC Berkeley said that it hasn't ever been used to a great extent, or it's been the minority. And I don't know if it's history or transportation costs. People in the industry would be able to say more why in the Midwest and in the East they use more coal tar. As far as a shift, I don't know, but there is that big regional difference, and the roads don't last any shorter in the mountains of the West than they do here.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, I would add to that in the cities that I surveyed as we prepared for this legislation was simply that the refineries they were buying their sealants from no longer sell coal tar-based sealants for those purposes. So I think there's a significant move away by most cities, and actually, as we heard, some of the big box stores are moving away from selling the product as well.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, our research showed that, again, not to repeat, but some of the big box places, the municipalities and the states have gone for their seal coating programs have gone to asphalt emulsion a long time ago. However, there are commercial applicators, the company that you'll hire to come and treat your driveway. There's at least one. When we first did our research, their sole product was coal tar based. And recently, during our hearing process, we had anecdotal comments that were submitted that some of those are already beginning to convert, but there's certain vendors, certain brand names out there that solely use the coal tar base yet.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Scalzi.
And Mr. Chair, I would like the PCA representative to identify himself and be available for questions.
Sure. If you could identify yourself and...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dale Thompson. I am a supervisor at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Municipal Stormwater. I can try and address that question a little, not a lot, to help maybe on the issue of preferences. I think there's buyer preferences. Sometimes buyers come in with a strong desire to have one product or the other. Maybe it's because of specific issues that they have on the pavement that they're sealing. For example, if they have a lot of fuel spillage or oil spillage, they may prefer to have coal tar. It's the applicator's preference, whether or not the employees want to use that material or don't want to use that material. They also are starting to blend products quite a bit too, so there may be a mixture of coal tar and asphalt in certain products that they're applying to.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question might be directed at Mr. Thompson and or Mr. Bolstead, I'm curious about the premise behind the notion that we categorize this as a hazardous waste. Mr. Bolstead pointed out very articulately that a lot of times the solution is dilution, and in addition to that, we know that these organic materials are successfully broken down in soils. Why aren't we entertaining the notion of land spreading this and letting the bacteria do their work? And then the follow-up to that would be, what is going to be the next product that's going to be of question in these materials or whatever, and it might lend itself to the same question. It seems to me that we might be violating common sense here.
Actually, I think you're not violating common sense at all. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, in the sense that you can't spread them on the surface because of basically atmospheric entrainment. It's at a concentration that's high enough. So there are PAHs you can, or levels you can pull out and you can spread. There are levels that are set by estimates of the carcinogenic capacity. So, for example, if you were to have mercury at a certain level, something you know, you can disperse it as opposed to having to hazardous waste it or landfill it. So it's a matter of the amount or the concentration. It's just too hazardous. It's like radiation. You know, we can accept some from the sunlight, but you're not going to let people take radiation waste from a nuclear power plant and spread it across the landscape to let it decay. It will eventually, but at some concentration it causes problems. And so how you dispose of it is a function of the concentrations, and the concentrations you're finding in these wastewater ponds are so high that that's not a safe way to treat it. The airborne entrainment is a problem, I think, if you spread it. Some of the methods that we're looking at to reduce the costs are through biocomposting, advanced biocomposting, looking at recombinant DNA or selecting for the microorganisms that will convert these things faster. But it's easier to just use the alternative and basically not put it in the landscape in the first place. There are other sources, and I think you're right. The idea is to try and treat them before they get into the anaerobic conditions in the water. So, for example, increasing the amount of pervious surface, using things like swales, vegetated swales, where you have high infiltration. Things as simple as crowding your driveway so that less of the water goes through the sewer pipe into the pond in the first place makes the most sense. You keep it from concentrating and expose it. But even at those rates, if you apply it to your driveway again and again, I would imagine folks doing soil sampling next to their driveways, if they've been applying this stuff for 40 years, probably have rates that if they were to grow plants aren't safe, and probably have high rates of the dust in their house. They just don't know it.
Okay. Thank you. And we do have one person that wants to testify in opposition to the bill as well. So I'd like to give them an opportunity now. Ms. Larray, I believe is the name. Hi. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Anne Lahire, and I'm the executive director of the Pavement Coatings Technology Council, which I passed out in your handouts. You should have a few slides, which just to help me remember what I want to say. So the PCTC, as we call it, is a 501c6 not-for-profit trade association. Our members are the manufacturers of refined tar-based sealers, Kotar sealers, if you will, and their suppliers. The manufacturers are almost without exception small businesses that are family-owned that have been in the family for generations. I brought with me here, not realizing that you could, Mr. Mike Fitzgerald, who is the branch manager for one of these manufacturers who has a facility in Ramsey, Minnesota. And since he knows the product very well, he might be able to answer some of your very product-specific or application-specific questions. So the PCTC, as I said, is focused on product stewardship. We engage in research, education, and training. It was reorganized about a year and a half ago to help address these issues that we're facing now. Before that, it was very much focused on product testing and standards and things like that. It was very much of an engineering center. So we have two manufacturing facilities. Our members have two manufacturing facilities in Minnesota. I don't believe there are any others. And the manufacturers here, the reason this is a very local type of manufacturing business is that they supply many contractors both in Minnesota and in neighboring states. So just to summarize what I'd like to, the two points that I really have is that this ban, and I would argue the 2009 law as well, would have little to no impact on PAHs in Minnesota pond, retention pond sediments. And thus, what would be the impact of this ban? It would be to harm small businesses in Minnesota. So on behalf of the PCTC and its members, I'd like to ask, you know, that eventually when you get around to making a decision that you vote no. So, but why is it that I feel so confident that you would have no impact? Well, some a while back, PCTC, we went to a leading expert in the field of PAH forensics. Now, environmental forensics was developed because of situations like this where you want to identify sources. So there's experts on dioxin forensics, on PCB forensics, and also on PAH forensics. And we asked the question, are sealants a significant source of PAHs in urban sediments? So what they do is they take all the samples, they look at, and they do a detailed evaluation of PAH chemistry. And in some cases, they can actually identify, they believe, fingerprints, you know, that it's that specific. Sometimes it's much more difficult. But as I said, these techniques are routinely used in legal proceedings to apportion responsibility for environmental PAH contamination. Some that you might be familiar with would include manufactured gas plants. You know, who's responsible for the PAHs around those? It played a large role in the Exxon Valdez litigation. So the next four slides are essentially what they gave me. I haven't seen the report yet from the forensics analysis, the full report, but I told them that there were issues here in Minnesota and asked them if they could provide me some information, since they told me that they were essentially were done with their evaluation. So they, just to say what they did, they used the published data from the USGS and from Minnesota and from other places around the country to compare a wide range of potential sources of PAHs, which, as our previous testifiers have said, you know, there's lots and lots of sources of PAHs because it's carbon, it's hydrogen, it's inorganic material, natural and in fossil fuels and in burning fossil fuels. So among the sources were the sealant itself, the product itself, parking lots, roof dust, atmospheric particles, soil, and highway runoff. And as they evaluated sediments from across the country to compare with these potential sources, including a 50-sample study of retention ponds in Minneapolis, as well as data from White Bear Lake. We had data of that from two ponds in White Bear Lake, and only one of them contained the you know, sufficient the PAHs to actually be evaluated. So to be quick, they apply six different forensic methods. The ones that work depend on the type of data that are available. So, not to get too far into the weeds, but the next two slides are just visual. You look at them and you can see the situation that we have, where we have the sealant product are in the circle in the lower right-hand quadrant of this graph. When they get out into the environment, you know, so they're subject to hydrolysis, to photolysis, to other things, and so the variation that can vary. But the point is that all of these dots are Minnesota pond sediments, and the sediments from the retention pond in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. And the conclusion of the forensic expert scientist was that the PAH source ratios in Minnesota are inconsistent with either the sealant itself or particles from the sealant from coal tar sealed parking lots. The second plot is very arcane. It's a principal component analysis, which I guess the point is it's a statistical method that looks for similarities and differences between you know, sets of data. And the trend lines that are written on here are I see a smile, so perhaps you know about principal component analysis.
Sorry,
more than I.
Motioning to somebody up on the next building.
Oh, I'm sorry. in any case, you can see that the trend analysis here for the sealed lots is different than the sediments. So so that's we have lots of other we have other science data that is being developed, but The bottom line here is that the forensic analysis do not support, either in general or in Minnesota, that the coal tar-based sealants are a significant source of PAHs, and indeed, it's hard to detect any signature of them at all in this data. So that's why I say that this proposed law, and perhaps even the 2009 law, are unlikely to have any impact on current or future concentrations or sources of PAHs in Minnesota pond sediments. On the other hand, the laws will harm small businesses in Minnesota, including the two manufacturing facilities Mr. Fitzgerald works for, the one in Ramsey that's a branch of Vance Brothers, which is a larger small business located throughout the Midwest. And then there's also another plant in Shakopee. The plant manager for the owner of that facility, which is a franchise of the Star Seal Group, which is nationwide, you know, throughout the country, he couldn't be here today with us. So then there are the customers who are throughout Minnesota, as well as neighboring states, many of whom have made a great investment in this particular technology and in the equipment used to apply this technology. There was I could finish here. I just wanted to point out, and I'll just very briefly say that our previous panel quite rightly said that there are alternatives. The questions about those alternatives, there are many questions. It's a complicated issue, many unanswered questions, and so one of which is, are they actually comparable? And another is, you know, the price fluctuations. So just many questions. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to take your questions. Excuse me.
Thank you, Dr. LaRay. And yes, and we do have one question. And just again, a reminder, I think we're not going to be getting to Representative Faulk's bill today. So for those who are here for, we'll try to reschedule that for another time if we can do that next week. But sorry about that, but we got our time cut short today.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's no problem. We were supposed to have a longer hearing, but again, things get changed quite quickly at the end here. Representative Purcell has a question, then I think we'll move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one familiar with principal component analysis and PAHs, could you provide for myself and perhaps the whole committee the studies and the hypotheses that they proceeded under, and who did those, and who you hired to do those, and
right.
I think that's very important. There's a wide range of expertise out in the field on
right.
this, and some of them think they're experts, but they really aren't. So I'd really like to have this information.
We went to Dr. Paul Bohm, who's a with Exponent, which is a consulting company. And he is the author. His name came to our attention because several years ago there was a book written about environmental forensics that had a chapter on each of the different subdisciplines, if you will. And he was the author of the one on PAH forensics. So that was what brought him to our attention.
Representative, thank you. That increases my need to know. I'm familiar with Exponent, and they're widely acclaimed in industry.
Right. And
not necessarily in PAHs, but within industry. They do a lot of work for industry.
And for government as well. And I would just say that in our contract with him, we didn't ask for a report. We asked him to prepare a publication, you know, for submission to a peer-reviewed journal. So my understanding is that manuscript is in preparation. And so it will appear in public, regardless of what the results were. That's what we asked him to do.
Please, Mr. Chair, please provide to us that journal. I hope it's in the one I subscribe to.
It's in Environmental Science and Technology. Is what they're going to submit it to. So
that's my journal. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. LaRay.
So.
One more question. Representative Duskowski.
Real quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Dr. LaHurry, could you could you comment on the ability of microbes in the soil if they're incorporated in a farm-type situation like we do, and I know can successfully be done with hydrocarbons from oil to gasoline to agricultural chemicals we use, and the ability of soils to successfully buffer and break down those particular hydrocarbons. Is there something specific about this one that that they aren't able to do the trick, or what can you tell us about that?
Dr. Luray.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Juskowski. Thank you. I'm not an expert in this field, but my understanding is that just as you have any organic material, there are microbes that will are able to use the particles from sealants just as they would any other particles that they found in the soils or in the sediments to as sources of food, and that is sources of energy. So I don't know what else I can say. As far as I know, there are no specific studies available on this. There are studies available about bioavailability and environmental remediation of bacterial remediation of coal tar based other coal tar based materials. The coal tar based industry, essentially, you know, coal tar is a byproduct of the steel industry. So when you make steel in your coking ovens, use coal, and one of the byproducts is coal tar, and that coal tar is then taken and refined in different ways for many different uses, just as petroleum out of the ground is refined. So,
thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Scalzi.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time, attention.
And I appreciate the committee's time, and this is a bill about prevention, and we're going to be working on this bill over the interim. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Representative Gardner, product stewardship.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see all my solid waste peeps out there today. Mr. Chair, we're not going to move the bill. We're not going to vote on it, but I just wanted to give an overview of the concept of a product stewardship framework that would have some benefits for taxpayers and maybe help solve some other problems. I'll dispense with my slides and just cut right to the chase. I think as members of this committee, we have listened to presentations on bills similar to the ones we just heard, where we may not necessarily feel qualified to make a decision about whether a product or service is harmful, and it's very hard for us to evaluate the evidence. And I've talked to the chair about maybe another way of doing that, and one of the concepts out there is a product stewardship framework bill. Excuse me. Turn off the phone. The idea is that you'd have a process by which you'd have people outside the legislature really evaluating the level of risk and the level of cost, so that we're not left here holding our hands up going, we don't know how to evaluate this because this isn't our area of expertise. But if I could just give some economic underpinnings for the concept here. When we have a solid or hazardous waste issue that imposes cost on society, what an economist would call an externality, we have a couple of choices. One is that we can kind of hope for personal responsibility and say, hey, don't throw that item away. We can ban things from disposal and the like. We can impose higher taxes or fees, usually at the local government level, or on consumers to try and address the issue. Or we can try and internalize that externality a little bit. I don't know if you have a phone on. This concept is about the idea of internalizing that externality, because I think it would be cheaper on a per unit cost and a more efficient way to go about it. Here's a couple of examples of taxes or fees that you may be familiar with. Folks in Iowa and Michigan would be familiar with container deposits, where you, while the consumer has a net zero, if they do the right thing, they pay a nickel and get back a nickel when they redeem a container. There's usually a handling fee paid by a bottler to a redemption center or a grocer in order to cover those fees. But it adds up. In the example of paint, we've heard paint bills that Representative Saylor's brought forth. Local governments are paying $6 million a year, roughly, on property taxes to keep paint from disposal. Another example would be in California. They took a different tack with their electronic waste bill, where you pay a fee at the point of purchase, which goes into a fund to pay recyclers to recycle electronic waste. There's some pros and cons with that version, which is the status quo and which we're trying to move away from. Those kinds of fees or taxes are often effective, but they tend to be more costly on a per-unit basis than a product stewardship approach, and it also spreads the cost to people who may not even use the product. Some of the those fees and taxes can actually be diverted to other uses by government. Anytime there's a big economic downturn, state governments look to funds that have accumulated from fees that have been paid in, and those can often be threatened with diversion to non-waste purposes. Those kinds of fees also generally don't send a market signal to manufacturers to design for the environment, so you can, in some cases, they sort of get off scot-free. They can keep making a product that poses a disposal problem, but there's a method to clean it up. But there's no market signal sent to say, let's maybe design this product to be less toxic. And finally, sometimes a fee or a tax is estimated by government. It actually has no basis in economics or price theory or anything else. It's just a number that's made up in order to bring in the necessary funds to clean up the problem. What we're proposing with a product stewardship approach is an internalization of externalities. Some examples of this would be, actually again in the beverage area, beverage manufacturers have actually bought and operated plastic recycling facilities, particularly in the Southeast, in order to provide enough bottle grade PET to use in new plastic bottles, and that's actually been an example of producer responsibility. The carpet industry has invested in recycling facilities to use or repurpose post-consumer carpet. We actually have a carpet recycling facility here in the Twin Cities. The electronics industry, because of our legislation here in Minnesota, is actually taking responsibility for electronic waste, where we don't pay a fee either in local government or as consumers, but the cost of dealing with that stuff is incorporated into the cost of the new product. There are some also pros and cons with this one, and I think that's worth some discussion today if we have any time. The consumer, the difference between a tax or a fee here is the consumer pays for whatever comes through, because businesses pass on costs to their consumers. However, that generally means that we have a lower per unit cost to actually clean up that product, because the private sector is actually the one finding the lowest cost per unit to manage that product, because they tend to be more innovative than government. No offense to my friends in government, but if they're faced with having to pay the cost, they're going to try and find the lowest cost. Yes, it does add an additional cost to business, but I would argue that, again, the private sector has the ability to innovate better than we do. It also forces manufacturers to innovate for better product design, which would be the opposite of the fee or tax model. This is also important. I've had a lot of people in government say that they prefer this model than a fee or tax model, because it keeps them out of the details. You don't have government micromanaging products. In California, for example, with the e-waste funds, they hire dozens of people just to monitor how the funds are being used and make sure they're being audited and make sure they're being spent in the right place, when they could just set the rules, as we do here in Minnesota, where we only have one employee who's really managing that whole program, and then we let the private sector take care of the rest. Why a framework approach? I've talked to many people in industry, and I think they would appreciate some predictability from the legislature. There's nothing stopping any of us from introducing a bill on whatever we want, on whatever product we want. That comes with some hazards, and that sometimes, for by hook or crook, we can get legislation passed that might be capricious in nature, or maybe not as effective as it could be, when we could use some more technical expertise. And as we've seen, like last night, people were discussing a Viking stadium at 11:30 at night, and you can wake up the next morning and find out something gets passed that you didn't necessarily want. I have some handouts for you in your packets. There's position statements from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the Association of Minnesota Counties, where they have standing positions that are more or less in favor of a producer responsibility approach to avoid cost to local government. Commissioner Reinhart can address that a little bit. The last thing I'll really mention here is that if this were to proceed next year, I think we'd be junking the bill language that we have now, because the state of Maine has done a lot of heavy lifting here. One of my colleagues in the Maine legislature put together legislation that was something like 100 pages long. They met with the Maine Chamber of Commerce. They had a very fruitful and lengthy discussion over a couple of months on how to address this issue to make sure the industry had a voice. And they came up with a 3 or 4 page bill, which I actually have in your packet. And there's some news clips there from the Maine Chamber of Commerce's newsletter praising the work that Representative Innes did in Maine to say this is a start, something that they can work with. I think the dynamics here in Minnesota might be a little different, but I've tried to lay my cards on the table with the Minnesota Chamber for the folks who deal with environmental issues to say, here's what we're hearing from Maine, here's how the discussion went, and we can talk about how we can maybe figure out, come up with a better way of doing things than we do now. And Mr. Robertson maybe can speak to that a little bit afterwards. But I'm going to just cut it short. I'm supposed to be in three places at once
okay.
right now. And Commissioner Reinhart actually is going to, talk to us about the local government impacts of this policy.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. And Ms. Reinhart, or Commissioner Reinhart.
Thank you. Good morning. And I realize that I have about 30 seconds, so I will be very brief, but do know that I can provide a lot more information when there's more time.
And I appreciate that. If you could state your name for the tape.
I am Dr. Victoria Reinhart. I am chair of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. I'm chair of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board and of the Association of Minnesota Counties Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And basically what it comes down to, and I have a bunch that I have written down here, but really what it comes down to is right now local governments are carrying the burden of end-of-life management of waste products. And we don't make any money off of it, obviously. And the manufacturers, if they could internalize those costs, would actually then the cost of disposing of it or the end-of-life management would be borne by the people that are actually using it and or manufacturing it, because they would simply pass that cost on. Right now, it's being borne by taxpayers. And when we look at all of the legislation that has passed over the last few years, electronics waste, and before that there were other products, and instead of doing this, really what a framework comes down to is, instead of doing this product by product by product and going through endless amounts of iterations on legislation, to have a framework in place that allows, as it does in Maine, that allows producers to sit at the table and say what works for us and what will how can we best internalize that cost, seems to make the most sense. And so to have a framework in place, really, it doesn't dictate exactly how something is going to be done, because each product is different, each manufacturing industry is different, but it does take the burden off of local government, who has no control over how the products are made, and asks the producers and manufacturers to take the lead on taking those costs and internalizing them. That's about as succinct as I can be.
Okay. And it seems to me that, the example of Maine, you see a lot of the producers and manufacturers playing a large role in developing this type of framework. It seems that there's some buy-in on the part of the producers. I don't know how much has occurred here in Minnesota. We're going to have, I know, Mr. Robertson coming up to testify as well, but I don't know if you could respond to that as far as how much interest there is on the part of the manufacturers in pursuing this more comprehensive framework to try to take care of the problem on the front end, I guess.
But Mr. Chair, I maybe wouldn't say that they're all the people who are watching in the audience today from industry aren't necessarily like craving a government intervention, but I think that they're also looking for a little bit more predictability. I should mention, I didn't state it clearly, what legislation would try to do, which is have a state agency, the PCA, give us some guidance on products that pose a particular toxic hazard, that are perhaps under-recovered, that could be recovered in higher quantities, or pose a significant cost to taxpayers. So I just want to say that there would be some criteria involved for what we're hoping to solve, so that we just don't make up products that we might find annoying, but they don't necessarily pose a hazard or a great cost. Mm-hmm. So people are always asking, what products are you talking about, Representative Gardner? And so there would be some language in some bill if they were to come forward next year to say, here's the criteria we're looking for to either give reassurance or to, I don't know, scare the pants off others. I don't, I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we do have Mr. Hickel would next. From the PCA.
I didn't have a chance to talk to Mr. Hickel, but his level of knowledge about stewardship and producer responsibility internationally is recognized pretty widely, and we may have to cut him short. Unfortunately, he's a great font of knowledge, but he certainly has a lot of background in the issue.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hickel.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Garth Hickel. I'm with the Product Stewardship Team at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And in the interest of time, I certainly understand that you have other commitments this morning. I thought I'd be very brief in terms of summarizing a report that the legislature asked the agency to provide in January 2009. Providing recommendations for a product stewardship framework, as well as I'd be happy to talk about what is occurring in relationship to framework approaches in the five other states that are looking at this issue. Just very quickly, as part of the state government financing bill coming out of the 2008 session, there was language requesting the agency provide recommendations on what a product stewardship framework potentially could look like for Minnesota. The agency moved forward with preparation of that report, with meeting with key stakeholder groups ranging from local government to the business community to environmental advocacy groups. We held two stakeholder meetings as part of that effort, and then issued a draft report in November of 2008 for review and comment by the various stakeholders, and then delivered the final report in January. And it essentially touched on several key issues. One is identifying the criteria for evaluating products, a process for designating those products, as well as how to facilitate the creation of industry-managed stewardship organizations. So essentially creating a pathway for the manufacturers to assume responsibility and, if they so choose, create a stewardship organization to be able to fulfill those responsibilities. How performance goals and metrics would be identified and monitored, as well as what would be the components of a stewardship plan, which is really kind of the keystone of a product stewardship framework approach. I will just simply focus on the criteria for evaluating products as well as the process for designating products. The agency essentially outlined three different buckets that the criteria would fall into, one being an analysis of potential adverse environmental and public health impacts, so looking at toxic or hazardous constituents of the product and opportunities for reducing waste and toxicity. Number two, an emphasis on opportunities for resource conservation, so looking at potential climate change impacts of the product, as well as potential resource recovery and materials conservation opportunities. And then lastly, does the product burden government solid waste programs and offer business opportunities? So essentially trying to address some of the issues that Commissioner Reinhart identified in terms of the amount of money that local governments are currently spending to manage those products, as well as identifying business opportunities for that would accrue with an expanded collection and processing infrastructure. And then secondly, the process for designating the products, and this again has been a big point of discussion in all of the framework discussions across the country, is what is that actual process and mechanism for designating those products? Is that something that is done on an administrative basis, or is it something that the legislature takes sole responsibility for? The PCA recommended a hybrid approach, if you will, where specific products would be analyzed according to the criteria by the agency and then submitted to the PCA Citizens Board for consideration, which would then hold a hearing about that potential recommendation. And then if the Citizens Board would approve that recommendation, it would be forwarded to the legislature for ultimate recommendation and potential approval in the stewardship framework. So with that, I know that was an extremely brief overview. I'd be happy to provide copies of the recommendations report to the members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions at all for Mr. Hickel? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, one reason I asked for the informational hearing is because if we did actually do this before deadlines, I think this would take like 5 to 10 hours to plow through, and I thought it would be better to just familiarize people and have that dialogue. So.
And welcome, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As you know, the Chamber has a very active environmental and natural resources program. We have a committee of more than 40 members that meets monthly, and we've been working on all of these issues, especially this one, for many years. And I just want to say at the outset how much we appreciate working with Representative Gardner. He has very extensive knowledge on all of the solid waste issues, and it is a pleasure to work with him and to have the opportunity to interact on these issues. I'm not sure how much time you have, but I have a few minutes that I want to give you about the Chamber's view of all of this. And I think starting out with just the terms, what is product stewardship? Because there have been a number of definitions of that over the years. One definition would say that product stewardship is shared responsibility, that all the players, anyone who has a function or an interest in a product from its development to its disposal has a shared responsibility with regard to that product. The definition that's included in the legislation is really what's called in another venue extended producer responsibility, and that's, I think, Representative Gardner was using that term earlier. So there's extended producer responsibility. What is product stewardship? In the end, the way product stewardship is defined in the bill is that the producer must manage the product at end of life. And viewing it from the business point of view, we really would say that that means product take back, essentially. That at the end of life of product, end of the life of the product, the producer of the product must take that product back and manage it in whatever way is appropriate. I do want to, and Garth started to cover, and he didn't have a chance to cover everything that's going on around the country, but I do want to mention that no state has passed a broad framework that establishes a general regulatory authority for such a program. And I want to talk about what Maine has done in a minute, but this kind of concept has been under consideration in Oregon, Washington, California, and of course Minnesota. In Maine, the original bill gave full authority to the state agency to adopt rules that would ban products or require extended producer responsibility, product take back. So the legislature was turning, in that original draft, full authority over to the state agency. And that bill, as you've heard, did not pass. The bill that became law in Maine allows the state agency to recommend products to the legislature for product stewardship and provide draft legislation to legislators. Representative Gardner's bill would establish that general statutory regulatory framework, but the legislature would still make final decisions on each individual product, a hybrid, as Mr. Hickel mentioned. Well, there is frustration in the community of stakeholders, as you've heard from the local units of government, from Representative Gardner talking about experience in the legislature. We've had that experience of working on batteries, on mercury lamps, on switches, on phone books, on paint and pharmaceuticals and electronics, and it takes a lot of time and it seems kind of messy. And so within all this frustration, I think the genesis of that PCA report that the legislature directed, that Mr. Hickel talked about, was to determine whether isn't there a better way to do this, and that's what Representative Gardner is interested in. So I'd like to comment on that, and as I begin on in commenting, I just want to give you the Chamber's general policy position on extended producer responsibility take-back legislation. We think that because of the nature of our economy, the interconnectedness of markets and commerce, that if legislation is needed to address these kinds of issues, it should be addressed at the federal level so that there's a level playing field in the marketplace. Now, it's easy to make that general statement. That is our general policy. The facts of life are you are working on these issues. Other legislators are working on these issues. These become state issues. And so I want to comment specifically on the approach in this bill and some of our conclusions about it, and then come in on the main situation. We've concluded that the general framework legislation in the current draft of Representative Gardner's bill will probably not improve the process. And maybe I should again talk about terms, because when we say framework, framework could mean the framework for discussion and debate of an issue with regard to a specific product, or framework could mean the establishment of a regulatory framework. The current draft of the bill does both. It establishes a general regulatory framework that would be in the law as a permanent statute. So the question is there a better way to do it? And as I said, stakeholders get frustrated. The process is messy. You know, it's like sausage making, as they say over here. But does this statutory framework help? And I think the way it is drafted now, it probably does not. We think that the concept of extended producer responsibility, take back of product at end of life, should be a rarely used tool. Establishing general regulatory authority with very broad criteria for inclusion creates the possibility that any product could be subject to what we think is an extreme measure, and the broadness of that framework, the regulatory framework, causes opposition, strong opposition, from any business that may think that its product could be subject to that regulatory framework. Representative Gardner talked about the philosophical avenues and the discussion about policy in terms of how best to address these kinds of issues. And I think when businesses look at the criteria that Mr. Hickel mentioned, and there's a little bit more within the bill itself, but when you look at that criteria, a business could conclude that under one of those criteria, my product could be included. So that is a problem with the current bill as it's drafted. Now, as I mentioned, the original Maine bill gave the state agency the full authority to do that, and we certainly wouldn't support anything like that. I think that the Minnesota experience has been that each product is different, and even a general framework will not solve the problem of how each product should be addressed. As you've seen, as your experience has been with the individual provisions that you passed with regard to electronics would not necessarily apply to pharmaceuticals or other products that may be under consideration. So from that point of view, you still need to have a political discussion and a policy discussion about the appropriateness of addressing this product. Does the concern about this product rise to the level of legislative action to take this, what we think is a very extreme step of requiring product take back. Now, on the other hand, if there is a general policy that is being promoted that intends to move in that direction of that this is going to be the common everyday way we do business in waste management with individual producers taking responsibility at end of life, then we would have strong concerns about that, and we would say our general comment would be that no system, no waste management system could work at that level. So it's somewhere in between, and in the judgments you've made decisions on which products are appropriate for some kind of stewardship, however that may be defined. So I'd like to close by a comment on the main legislation. We think there may be some promise in the main proposal. There's no general regulatory framework that's established within that legislation. It allows the state agency to come forward to the legislature with some analysis of some specific products. We have not had the opportunity within our committee to specifically review the main legislation, and we'll be doing that in the coming months, and we'll be interested in working with Representative Gardner to look at that issue. I'd like to close by saying that extended producer responsibility, this take-back concept, should not be viewed as a simple solution to solve a waste management problem. First, producers generally don't act in concert, and one of the key things, if you had all these producers producing product and now being required to take care of it, it almost demands that producers act in concert at that moment at the end of life. In fact, we have laws that prevent producers from acting in concert, and you've had to suspend those laws in order to pass some of this legislation. In many ways, in today's marketplace, competition is resulting in goods product stewardship. Companies are competing now to show that their products are less likely to harm the environment with products that are less toxic and more sustainable. And I think the evidence of that is clearly all of the advertising you see on television or wherever it may be. Everyone is advertising their product as the greenest product or the best product in a sustainable environment. Second, the process of life cycle assessment needs to be a critical tool in determining whether a product take-back approach is the right policy. Will take-back actually result in an environmental benefit? Now, I understand that British Columbia, which has an extended producer responsibility law, has about 13 product stewardship programs, and that there are more on the way. How do these separate systems relate? Is more fuel consumed in hauling and managing products, thereby increasing pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions? So in the end, any program must have a net environmental benefit and not simply be designed to fix a single part of a large and complex waste management system. Third, the Chamber's definition of product stewardship includes that concept of shared responsibility. Lots of people in the life cycle of a product benefit from its use, including society as a whole. And if only one party has the ultimate responsibility, there's little incentive for others to make a system work cost effectively. And finally, we believe that a competitive marketplace must be maintained not only for products, but also for recycling, that business, and end-of-life management, a major business in and of itself. Real competition in addressing all of these problems will ensure the best environmental performance at the lowest cost. So those are our comments, Mr. Chairman. We know it's a very complex issue, and we will look forward to working with Representative Gardner and the committee in the coming months and session to find a way to make this work better. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Any questions? It sounds like you feel that the concept itself of a comprehensive framework just wouldn't work because of the uniqueness of products, and that it's better to do it on a more piecemeal basis where you're looking at products that may create problems in the future, but not trying to get out ahead of it with a general framework.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the case. We all know the general framework of how you would end up in addressing a product, but there are so many issues and complexities with regard to each product that we don't see the benefit of establishing a general regulatory framework within the statute.
Okay. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Robinson, I would just like to agree with you that we certainly know that there is nothing simple about anything having to do with solid waste. Just bring up any bill and you'll find that out. But I do think that it's very worthwhile to pursue Representative Gardner's bill in looking at a framework, because I just look at the infinite amount of time that has been spent on doing things piecemeal, not only from the point of view of the legislature, but certainly from industry and from all of the counties, everyone that's involved with it, and all of the solid waste people. So I think it's probably in the best interest of everyone to look at some way we can at least, you know, look at, as we say, that general framework. What things can we look at on the top that allow all of the entities to work together on the individual things, which, as you say, certainly, you know, the properties of electronics are not a great deal like the properties that we worry about with pharmaceuticals. But, you know, overall, I think that just far too much time is spent on it, everyone's behalf, trying to figure out how to make this happen. So it would occur to me that looking at a general framework and emphasis on that word general would be a benefit to everyone, because we recognize all of the complexities.
Any other questions for
Mr. Chair, if I could just make some closing comments. I really appreciate the conversations, the open discussions that, Mr. Robertson and I and Mr. Quillis and Mr. Grooms have had from the business community. I think that makes some interesting and valid points, and you know, they aren't simple issues, and I look forward to talking with them after session and see where it goes.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, meeting is adjourned.